We're continuing with the Buddhist history class and looking at the various legends and biographies of the Buddha that we started looking at last week. And this is by no means meant to be a comprehensive survey of these things, but just looking at a few examples and getting a general familiarity with the terrain. And last week, just to briefly run over, I made the suggestion that the earliest form of the Buddha's life would have been remembered by people as episodes in the Buddha's life, that these were gradually assembled to form narratives of some of the more important parts of the Buddha's life. And the most significant of these narrative portions that became quite extensive shortly after the Buddha passed away were the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and the Chaturparisad Sutra on the first part of the Buddha's life. And I think these narratives were assembled by principally Ananda and his school. And as time went on, these two were united and formed together with some other narratives to form what we call the Khandaka section of the Vinaya. And following that, there was the formation of the maybe call the mature or classical phase of the Buddha biographies. So we're now talking in a period between, say, 300 to, say, 700-800 years after the Buddha's life, after the Buddha's passing away. And it's these mature period biographies which form the definitive telling of the Buddha's life from then on, and which for the Buddhist community constituted the life of the Buddha, and which constituted the primary source of knowledge and information, not only about the Buddha himself, but about Buddhism. So that if you go into any temple, you're very likely to see pictures depicting episodes from this sort of classical period life of the Buddha. For example, the picture of the white elephant entering the belly of Maya, signifying her conception, and so on. And so these become the principal way that Buddhism is transmitted to the populace. And we had a look at a few examples of the Buddha biographies last week. In particular, we looked at the Lalita Vistara, the play in extenso, which we noted was extremely florid. And we had a look, I believe we had a look at something from the Mahavastu, if I remember correctly. And we may have had a look at something, this the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya version. And a couple of other versions we haven't looked at. And these have their own characteristics. The Mulasarvastivada Vinaya version obviously is still embedded in the Vinaya, so it still keeps the characteristics of the Khandakas to it. The Mahavastu is ostensibly called a Vinaya text, although it has little about Vinaya to it, and the Mahavastu of the Mahasanghika Lokuttaravadins is a sprawling, disorganized mess.
So is that the one that's on the screen?
Right? That's the Mahavastu, oh, yeah. Mahasanghika. Yeah. And it's basically just... Yeah, Lokuttaravada is one of the branches of Mahasanghika. Yeah. So they just threw everything in there. And it's... Well, an interesting literary artefact. And some of the other ones, one of which I couldn't find last week, I think we have the book somewhere here, but I can't locate it, is the, I found it online, is the, I think I found it online, the Jataka Nidana. I think I've gone and lost it. I had it before. Anyway, the Jataka Nidana, hopefully we can find it again. And the Buddhacharita of Ashvaghosha. And another one that we have here is the Abhinishkramana Sutra. Okay, available in Chinese translation and partly in Sanskrit. So, what I'd like to do for this session is to have a look at some of these versions. We'll see how many we get through, and focusing on one particular passage. So we'll read one episode from the Buddha's life story, and we'll look at it from all of these different texts or from a few of the different ones, and then we'll see what similarities or differences we might find between them. And the passage that I've chosen to use is the story of the attack of Mara and the defeat of Mara just before the Buddha's enlightenment. So this being an episode which is, of course, in the earliest form of the Buddha's enlightenment, is of course entirely a psychological thing. It's the defeat of the defilements and so on. There's a tendency in the Sutta Nipata to depict this as Mara's, as like an actual argument with Mara, as a Devaputta and his 10 armies. But even then, his 10 armies are merely 10 kinds of defilements, and not really depicted as armies as such. But of course, it's a bit difficult to depict a defilement if you're drawing a picture, or if you're making a play, or if you're trying to tell a fun story. And so the Buddhist tradition turned this figurative and metaphorical army into a very literal one. And we're going to be having a look at a few different examples of this army of Mara. And so the first one, just to choose one random account of this, is from Ashvaghosha's Buddhacharita. Now this Buddhacharita, which gives you the Sanskrit text in Devanagari here, which will be very useful for most of you, and translation, good addition here. This is actually, the translation on the screen is from an earlier, and this translation on the screen is from the Chinese rather than from the Sanskrit, but this Sanskrit text is incomplete. Now Ashvaghosha, I'll just give a little bit of background onto Ashvaghosha. His dates here given 80 to 150 CE roughly, that's a stab in the dark, was an Indian philosopher poet born in Saketa in northern India, believed to have been the first Sanskrit dramatist, somewhat dubious, and considered the greatest Indian poet prior to Kalidasa, or sometimes considered the greatest Indian poet of all time. A.K. Warder says that A.K. Warder is the foremost expert in the Western world on Indian literature generally. He wrote a several volume survey of the entire sphere of Indian literature, and he had the opinion that Ashvaghosha was one of the five or six greatest writers of all time anywhere. Ashvaghosha was the most famous in a group of Buddhist court writers whose epics rivaled the contemporary Ramayana, whereas much of the Buddhist literature prior to the time of Ashvaghosha had been composed in Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. Ashvaghosha wrote in classical Sanskrit. So here's a stage in turning the life story of the Buddha into a very high-quality, cultured Sanskrit text. He was first a student of non-Buddhist teachings, but soon, losing an argument with Parshva, converted to Buddhism. He became a religious advisor to the Kushan king Kanishka, dubious. He is not a Mahayanist, and seems to have been ordained into a subsect of the Mahasanghikas. If he was indeed a monk, he may have been a layperson. I'm not sure about that. Mahasanghikas, yeah, again, maybe not much was really known about him. He's said to be the author of the influential Buddhist text, The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana, although modern scholars agree that that text was composed in China. He also wrote an epic life of the Buddha called Buddhacharita, which is what we're looking at, and the Mahalankara. He also wrote Saundarananda Kavya, a Kavya poem, that's a literary poem, with the theme of the conversion of Nanda, the Buddha's half-brother, so that he might reach salvation. So if you remember this story, the conversion of Nanda was the fellow who abandoned his wife on the eve of his going forth because of the promise that he'd get the celestial nymphs who would outshine his glorious wife. So that's very telling, actually, as to Ashvaghosha's attitude and preferences. And again, Warder describes Ashvaghosha. He says that his literary genius was that he was able to depict in the delights of sensual pleasures at great length and with total sincerity, and that he was able to write about how glorious all of these sensual pleasures were, and with equal eloquence and sincerity to dismiss them all and to say how meaningless and empty they were in the very next line. So this water reads as telling us something quite deep about Ashvaghosha's own character. So, and of course that sense of tension is, the internal tension is what makes great religious art as opposed to, or great art in general, as opposed to merely a kind of hagiography. So this is, so as compared, for example, to what I mentioned before, say the Mahavastu, which is a kind of loosely assembled sort of melange of all different things, Ashvaghosha's text is extremely refined literary text. Okay, so we'll read his account of the defeat of Mara and see what he has to say about it. The great Rishi of the royal tribe of Rishis beneath the Bodhi tree firmly established, resolved by oath to perfect the way of complete deliverance, the spirits, Nagas, and the heavenly multitude. So remember, this is just after the event of having the milk rice with Sujata. The spirits, Nagas, and the heavenly multitude all were filled with joy, but Mara, Deva Raja, the enemy of religion, alone was aggrieved and rejoiced not. Lord of the five desires, that's the five sense desires, skilled in all the arts of warfare, the foe of those who seek deliverance, therefore his name is rightly given Pisuna. Now this Mara Raja had three daughters, mincingly beautiful. Okay, this is translated in about 1873 or something like that. So some of the English is, and it's translated from Sanskrit into Chinese and from Chinese into English. So very, shall we translate, very beautiful, enticingly beautiful perhaps, and of a pleasant countenance in every way fit by artful ways to inflame a man with love, highest in this respect among the devis. The first was named Yuyen, lust, pollution, the name, and these are the three names, is Tamha, Rati, and Raga, in Sanskrit or Pali. These three at this time advanced together. They addressed their father, Pisuna, and said, may we not know the trouble that afflicts you? The father, calming his feelings, addressed his daughters thus. The world has now a great sage. He has taken a strong oath as a helmet. He holds a mighty bow in his hand. Wisdom is the diamond shaft he uses. His object is to get mastery in the world, to ruin and destroy my territory. I am myself unequal to him, for all men believe in him, and all find refuge in the way of his salvation. Then will my land be desert and unoccupied. But as when a man transgresses the laws of morality, his body is then empty. So now the eye of wisdom, not yet opened in this man, whilst my empire still has peace, I will go and overturn his purpose and break down and divide the ridgepole of his house. Seizing then his bow and five arrows, with all his retinue of male and female attendants, he went to that grove of fortunate rest with the vow that all the world should not find peace. Then seeing the sage quiet and still, preparing to cross the sea of the three worlds, in his left hand grasping his bow, with his right hand pointing his arrow, he addressed Bodhisattva and said, Kshatriya, rise up quickly, for you may well fear your death is at hand. You may practice your own religious system, but let go this effort after the law of deliverance for others. Wage warfare in the field of charity as a cause of merit. Appease the tumultuous world, and so in the end reach your reward in heaven. This, so of course this has been the great feature of Mara in Buddhism, is that Mara is telling people to do good, do merit, go to heaven. Yeah? This is so conniving and skillful is Mara. This is a way renowned and well established in which former saints have walked, rishis and kings and men of eminence, but this system of penury and alms begging is unworthy of you. Now then, if you rise not, you had best consider with yourself that if you do not give up your vow and tempt me to let fly an arrow, how that Ayla, grandchild of Soma, by one of these arrows just touched as by a fanning of the wind, lost his reason and became a madman. So here Ashvaghosha obviously referring to what would have been well-known legends at the time. I'm not familiar with that particular legend. Ida, the grandson of Soma, that's a reference to a Brahmanical legend. And now the Rishi, and how the Rishi Vimala, practicing austerities, hearing the sound of one of these darts, his heart possessed by great fear, bewildered and darkened, he lost his true nature. So here, what Ashvaghosha is doing is that in the Indian tradition generally, the idea that the sage should be tempted by desire or should be attacked by Mara or someone is a standard trope in the Indic stories, and we find this again and again and again in all of the Brahmanical myths. And so Ashvaghosha, as being one who is taking part in these myths, is actually invoking these older stories which would have been known to his audience to illustrate the same episode, same thing is happening in his case. So this is like a bit of comparative mythology. How much less can you, a late-born one, hope to escape this dart of mine? Quickly arise then, if hardly you may get away. This arrow full of rankling poison, fearfully insidious where it strikes a post. See now, with all my force I point it, and are you resting in the face of such calamity? How is it that you fear not this dread arrow? Say why you do not tremble. Maras uttered such fear-inspiring threats, bent on overawing the Bodhisattva. But the Bodhisattva's heart remained unmoved. No doubt, no fear was present. Then Mara instantly discharged his arrow while the three women came in front. This is his three daughters, of course. But the Bodhisattva regarded not the arrow, nor considered the three women. Mara, the king, was now troubled much with doubt, and muttered thus, twixt heart and mouth. Long since the maiden of the snowy mountains shooting at Maheshvara constrained him to change his mind, and yet Bodhisattva is unmoved. And of course, this again referring to comparative mythology, this is referring to the temptation of Shiva, and his he was tempted by Karma, the god of love, as he in his mountaintop abode. It's been one of the most famous of all the Hindu mythology. And he heeds not even this dart of mine, nor the three heavenly women. Naught prevails to move his heart or raise one spark of love within him. Now must I assemble my army host and press him sore by force. Having thought thus a while, Mara's army suddenly became assembled around. So one interesting detail about this one is that he Buddha goes Ashvaghosha, and it seems to me a bit uncharacteristic of him, but he doesn't dwell on the whole episode of the temptation by Mara's daughters, and it just sort of mentioned in passing and not described in detail. But then when it comes to the army, then he goes into a lot more extravagant detail. Each assumed his own peculiar form. Some were holding spears, others grasping swords, others snatching up trees, others wielded diamond maces. Thus were they armed with every sort of weapon. Some had heads like hogs, others like fishes, others like asses, others like horses. Some with forms like snakes or like the ox or savage tiger, lion-headed, dragon-headed, and like every other kind of beast. Some had many heads on one body trunk, with faces having but a single eye, and then again with many eyes, some with great-bellied, mighty bodies, and others thin and skinny, bellyless, others long-legged, others mighty-kneed, others big-shanked and fat-calved. So obviously these are very descriptions of every kind of ogre that you can imagine, headless, breastless, faceless.
It's like a big battle between Mordor.
Oh, it is, yeah, absolutely, yeah. 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 This is Ashvaghosha, Buddha Charita. What do you mean, which actual text is it?
This is
Ashvaghosha's Buddha Charita. Yeah? Translated from Chinese. Yeah? By Samuel Beal. And of course, you find these depictions in the Buddhist artwork with the kind of their favorite thing of the armies of Mara and so on. You find modern versions of that in Thailand. Some of the modern artists do it with, they've got kind of machine guns and bazookas and tanks and things like that. Name of the Chinese text, let me see. The Foshor Hing Sang King. How is that supposed to be pronounced? Not sure. It's translated a long time ago. So it's translated 1883. Mm-hmm. So it's probably an old transliteration system. So I'm not quite sure how it's supposed to be pronounced. Qing. Of course, yeah. Buddhacharita available online. Is this the answer? Oh, it's taken to the same thing we just got. Oh, hang on. Here we have translated from the Sanskrit. Good, we have both of them. But only part of it. Okay, where were we now? Lost. Ah. Okay, so, done with tinkling bells, waving, wheeling round the air, flying, howling, hooting, evil noises, and so on. Thus, this wicked goblin troop encircled on its four sides the Bodhi tree, some bent on tearing his body to pieces, others on devouring it whole. From the four sides, flames belched forth, and fiery steam ascended up to heaven. Tempestuous winds arose on every side, the mountain forest shook and quaked. Fire, wind, fire, and steam with dust combined to produce a pitchy darkness, rendering all invisible. And then the devas, who were affectionate to the Dhamma, and all the nagas and spirits, were incensed at this host of Mara. With anger fired, they wept tears of blood. And the great company of Sudavasa gods, pure abode gods, beholding Mara tempting the Bodhisattva, free from low feeling, with hearts undisturbed by passion, moved by pity towards him and commiseration, came in a body to behold the Bodhisattva so calmly seated and so undisturbed, surrounded with an uncounted host of devils shaking the heaven and earth with sounds ill-omened. Bodhisattva, silent and quiet in the midst, remained, his countenance as bright as before, unchanged, as like the great lion king placed among all the beasts howling and growling round him. So he sat, a sight unseen before, so strange and wonderful. And then it goes on, more descriptions of the demon horde. Their flying spears, lances and javelins stuck fast in space, refusing to descend. The angry thunderdrops and mighty hail with these were changed into five-coloured lotus flowers, while the foul poison of the dragon snakes was turned to fragrant air. So this, of course, being very famous detail, is the transformation of the weapons into flowers and fragrance. No, well, we'll have a look at the Pali version in a minute, yeah? So this is not directly related to the Pali version. The countless sorts of creatures wishing to destroy the Bodhisattva, unable to remove him from the spot, were wounded with their own weapons. Now, Mara had an aunt attendant, whose name was Mahakali, probably Mahakali, okay? So it's no doubt the Hindu goddess Kali, and quite aptly described as Mara's auntie, who held a skull dish in her hands and stood in front of the Bodhisattva and with every kind of winsome gesture tempted to lust the Bodhisattva. So all these followers of Mara, possessed of every demon body form, united in discordant uproar, hoped to terrify the Bodhisattva, but not a hair of his was moved. And Mara's host was filled with sorrow. Then in the air, the crowd of angels, their forms invisible, raised their voices, saying, "Behold, the great sage, his mind unmoved by any feeling of resentment, whilst all that wicked Mara race, besotted, are vainly bent on his destruction. Let go your foul and murderous thoughts against that silent sage, calmly seated. You cannot with a breath move the Sumeru mountain. Fire may freeze, water may burn, the roughened earth may grow soft and pliant, but you cannot hurt the Bodhisattva. Through ages past, disciplined by suffering, the Bodhisattva, rightly trained in thought, ever advancing in the use of means," that's a upaya kushala, "skillful means, pure and illustrious for wisdom, loving and merciful to all. These four conspicuous virtues cannot with him be rent asunder, so as to make it hard or doubtful whether he gain the highest wisdom. For as the thousand rays of yonder sun must drown the darkness of the world, or as the boring wood must kindle fire, or as the earth deep dug gives water, so he who perseveres in the right means by seeking thus will find." And so they go on in their praise of the Bodhisattva. which I won't read through all of that. Mara, hearing these sounds in space, so of course these being the teachings of the devas, and seeing the bodhisattva still unmoved, filled with fear and banishing his high and supercilious thoughts, took his way to heaven above, while all his hosts were scattered, overwhelmed with grief and disappointment, fallen from their high estate, bereft of their warrior pride, their warlike weapons and accoutrements, thrown heedlessly and cast away amid woods and deserts, like as when some cruel chieftain slain, the hateful band is all dispersed and scattered, so the host of Mara, disconcerted, fled away. The mind of Bodhisattva now reposed peaceful and quiet. The morning sun beams brighten with the dawn. The dust-like mist dispersing disappears. The moon and stars pale their faint light. The barriers of the night are all removed, while from above a fall of heavenly flowers pay their sweet tribute to the Bodhisattva. So that's Ashvaghosha's account. Very dramatic, focusing on the violence of the horde of Mara and the replies by the devas, the Buddha, of course, keeping silent and still among all of the controversy, backwards and forwards. And a few things not mentioned there. One thing that's not mentioned is the calling the earth goddess to witness, which you find in some versions. And as I said, the account of the temptation by Mara's daughters, very abbreviated. And we have the introduction of Kali as the Hindu deity. So here we have another version. And it was, before we go on, any comments or anything about that particular version? Some of it was in the Little Buddha, but it hasn't been done like really well. Yeah. Okay, so here let's have a bit of a look at the Mahavastu. And so remember, as I said, Mahavastu being much more of a compilation of various materials as opposed to the literary masterpiece of Ashvaghosha. Just trying to get this readable. That's not too bad. So again, I find it somewhat curious that all of these texts that I'm working for, just as a note, were, most of them were translated 100 years ago and so, where there was an actual lot of interest in mythology in European culture, and where these things were translated, which in a sense is good for us because it means that they're public domain, so we can get them on the internet. But it also means that in most of these, as far as I'm aware, there's not been sort of updated and corrected versions of it, even though our understanding of the text has improved a lot since then. So the previous part in this is another episode, which I won't go into. And here's the appearance of Mara's bodhisattva seated there at the Bodhi tree. And then wicked Mara flew through the air to where the Bodhi tree was, and standing in the air, he adored the Bodhisattva with his joined hands raised. Okay? So Mara's coming along and bowing down and paying respects to the Bodhisattva. And Bodhisattva addressed him, "Thou standest in the airy sky, eager and alert like the king of beasts, with thy hands joined in adoration and veneration. Thou dost here venerate him who is worthy to be adored." So the all kind of vows and the dosts and things like that is actually not inappropriate, because the language of the verses in the Mahavastu is different and probably older than the language of the prose. So in keeping that translation, I think it's probably quite deliberate by the translator. Mara said, "Lo, I am a lord, the wise sovereign of all creatures, knowing ease and ill and understanding the cause of them in the world, so that thou, O glorious hero, mayest have good health in the days of thy youth, enjoy the pleasures of men, and live in thy father's house. Dwell in the great, joyous, and rich sea-girt land, O Gotama, rule thy realm, offering the great sacrifices, the horse sacrifice, the human sacrifice, the white lotus sacrifice, and the sacrifice of the unbarred house." Of course, these being some of the great Brahmanical sacrifices, especially the horse sacrifice being the most important one for establishing sovereignty. Does anyone know what the horse sacrifice involved? Horse sacrifice? Horse sacrifice is great. I shouldn't say that, but it doesn't just mean killing a horse, but it's this whole kind of thing. It goes on for a year. You get a horse, you release it, and then you have a band of men follow the horse around wherever it goes, and wherever the horse wanders, you claim that on behalf of your king. Okay? So if the horse decides to wander into the next door country, you have to go there with your army and take it over. And so it's only people who are very confident that are kind of willing to do the horse sacrifice. And then at the end of the year, the horse is got and is actually sacrificed. And there's this absolutely bizarre ritual that goes on with that sacrifice. They've done it in, I think they were doing it in recorded history. They wouldn't do it now. Yeah. There are examples of it being done historically. So it's described in the Vedas and so on. But they actually, the climax of the event, the horse is killed and then it's covered with a blanket, and the chief queen gets underneath the blanket with the horse and simulates intercourse with the horse while she's under there, while having a bawdy, joke-filled dialogue with the chief priest and with all these kind of innuendos and so on about her and her relations with the horse as it's going on. And this is the greatest ritual in the Vedic thing.
It must be. I mean, it comes down from the Aryans and the sort of, you know, conquering all with their chariots.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's.
So the horse is dead, I guess.
Yeah. So the horse sacrifice it's really out there. Yeah. Okay. There we go. When you've offered those sacrifices, you will become an immortal god. For having offered these sacrifices, the Trayashtrimsha, the Tavatinsa Devas and those of Indra are happy. Do thou, my friend, listen then and do as I say, lest thou be lost in the future through abandoning the joys of this pleasant present world. So, of course, Mara here being on behalf of the Vedic and Brahmanical religion. These were the verses that Mara spoke before the Bodhisattva, and to him speaking thus, the Bodhisattva replied, O thou wanton of thought, thou wicked one, with what intent have you come hither? You are no lord, nor king, nor Brahma, nor Pajapati. If you were a lord, you would not supplicate me with your joined hands. I have no delight in prosperous birth, whether low, high, or mean. I am indifferent to you. I have no delight in the pleasures of prosperity I have no delight in the five strands of sensual pleasure. I've broken, like an elephant has broken its snare or rent its bonds and goes wherever it's wished, so too I have broken the bonds that bound me to my home and on my way to a fair city. Behold the Dharma, did those in the sky exclaim. So the Devas in the sky exclaiming. And then Mara flew again to the air where the Bodhi tree was and stood in the air. The Bodhisattva said to him, Who are you? And Mara replied, I am the Lord that intoxicates Devas and men, the fair Suras and Asuras who dwell in my domain, though caught in the cage of recurrent birth, are overcome by intoxication and drunk with pleasure. They escape the snare of death. But he who had vision of the highest good, the great seer on his throne, replied to Mara with melodious speech. His words perfectly befitted one who was endued with an ocean of virtue and had the tone of the bull voice of the bull man. Brave in heart art thou, if thou art lord over thyself. If thou art lord over sensual desires, then thou art truly without a lord. The sons of the kings of men are sick with love of women. Men with diadems of pendant gems and jewels fall in the mire. Then on the backs of these men, the great lords who have thus succumbed, wanton women fall, who caught in the impulse of their desire, passion, and intoxication laugh. And at that moment, these women are become the slaves of Yama. Thou who art fallen under the thraldom of women, vauntest thy sovereignty. Behold how you are deluded. There is no sovereignty for him who is afflicted by sensual desires. There neither has been nor will be. Of this I am certain. I am he who this day has in fight vanquished you and your power. When the rising sun begins to shine, I shall become Buddha. For, O Dark One, none who has sat upon this throne in his last incarnation fails to arise as a Buddha. Mara said, Why do you roar as you sit at your ease by the fair tree? Don't you yet see with their thousand warlike crests the armed hordes of Pishachas, this kind of demon, with many a Rakshasa is another kind of demon, and many a Yaksha is another kind of demon, a glad host of four arms equipped with many a magical device. And Bodhisattva replied, were Nayutas of Kotis, these being hugely, vastly large numbers, meaning were hundreds of billions of Maras assembled, a gathering of able heroes in a pent-up flood, I would not move a hair because of them, much less because of thee, thou son of darkness. Go thy way. Why do you prate to no purpose? So interesting, there's already kind of quite a difference between this and Ashvaghosha's one. In Ashvaghosha's, he is much more silent, wasn't he? He didn't really engage with Mara, he just sort of sat there. Here he's engaging in quite a stern interchange. Mara, thus rebuffed by the Bodhisattva, went back to his own abode and told his retinue. And his son named Janisutta, never heard of him before, this must be only from this one. Father, don't hinder him. Let him awaken to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. I have learnt what his conception was like, what his birth and what his leaving home, and how he came to the Bodhi tree and sat there. Today he will awaken to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. There is no being or collection of beings capable of stopping the Bodhisattva from winning the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. And so then he goes on to repeat the similar one in verse, which I won't read. But then Kala, who's Mara's minister, spoke these verses. Everyone who follows his own haughty design without sense or wit falls into folly, like Janisutta here, my lord, who ill-advised gives improper counsel. Then Mara, having donned his great armor, came near to the Bodhisattva. So notice how abrupt this transition is. You know, you had this response from Mara's son. And then Mara's son responded to by the minister. But Mara himself doesn't actually respond to any of that. He just puts on his armor and goes. So again, this is, you wouldn't find this in Ashvaghosha's version. So this is an example of the sort of poor editing of the Mahavastu. These things are just jammed in there, one next to each other. Mara, having donned his great armor, came near to the Bodhisattva. But he was routed by the mere sound of the Bodhisattva's cough. And again did Mara don his great armor, and drew near to the Bodhisattva at the foot of the Bodhi tree with his great army of four arms, including Kumbhandas, Yakshas, and Rakshasas, making the whole ground for 30 yojanas around to throb. That's about 100 miles. He mounted his chariot, to which 1,000 horses had been yoked, carrying a dazzling bow, armored and mailed, with banners and flags flying to the accompaniment of many drums, tabors, kettle drums, cymbals, and trumpets, and attended by an army of frightful and monstrous beasts, which made a rumbling clamor. Some of these beasts had the faces of horses, others of buffaloes, some of asses, goats, rams, deer, lions, tigers, and so on and so forth. Some were headless, one-eyed, many-eyed, two-headed, and so on, as much as we found in Ashvaghosha's version, all kinds of distortions and yes, right, some brandished in the air wheels with blades on their rims. So this is the use of the chakra, the discus, as a weapon. But the Bodhisattva did not turn a hair or change his heart, and then repeats much the same thing in verse. Again, very characteristic of Buddhist literature to have the same or similar tale told both in verse and in prose. But the Bodhisattva, imbued with the roots of virtue acquired through several kotis of kalpas, several millions of eons, thrice stroked his head and thrice his bent knee. Then he struck the earth with his right hand, a gem of a hand, marked with a bright streak, beautified by being painted with the essence of lac, soft like cotton to the touch and with copper-coloured nails. Okay, so this is how beautiful the Buddha, the Bodhisattva's hands were. And the earth thus struck reverberated deeply and distinctly. It resounded and re-echoed. Just as a vessel of metal made in Magadha, when beaten on the mountaintop, resounds and re-echoes deeply, so did the earth when struck by the Bodhisattva's hand. And just as a note in passing, we were talking and discussing the Samanyapada Sutta and the ultimate victory of Magadha over the other kingdoms in India. And one of the reasons why it's been suggested that Magadha was ultimately successful is because of their metal working. And here the metal made in Magadha is used as proverbial. And apparently they had a lot of iron mines in Magadha. So this may have been what ultimately enabled their military success. And they also had a lot of elephants. And Mara's army, as it reverberated, was split, torn, broken up, and turned away. Their elephants, horses, and chariots collapsed. Their feet, hands, and weapons collapsed. They lost their direction, and taking the wrong way, they fell into the river Naranjana. Some fell on their right, left side, others on their right, others on their backs, others on their feet, others on their knees, others on their heads, and others on their faces. In fear and terror, they cried out to one another. And others of the demon host sobbed and wept. Meanwhile, devas rained down flowers of the coral tree and of the other celestial trees, and in exultation acclaimed the victory of the prince. In the sky there were roars of drums and shouts of hurrah re-echoed in the three worlds. The clear firmament was shaken when the master won his victory. So in this particular one, he won his victory by striking the earth like a drum with his hand. Okay, so then this being retold by a deva, and then the final description of his enlightenment. In the last watch of the night, in the flush of dawn towards daybreak, he awakened to all that. The man, the true man, the great man, the bull man, the real man, the heroic man, the elephant man, the lion man, the leader of men, the red lotus man, and various other kinds of man, who abides in the right way, and so on. To all this, the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment, he awakened through insight gained in a momentary flash of thought. Okay, so it's interesting. This is a momentary flash is the actual awakening. And then the dependent origination became manifest towards him. Okay. And then Mara fashioned vicious-minded creatures to break up the throne of the Exalted One, but when the sun rose, they all melted away. On that occasion, the Exalted One made the solemn utterance. So these bits here, when these dhammas become manifest to a zealous and contemplative Brahman, then all his doubts appear, for he understands the decay of causes and things in the cause. These verses, three verses here, actually appear in the Pali at the beginning of the Vinaya. Okay, so the opening, remember that I said that the Khandaka narrative starts out with the enlightenment as one of the earliest forms of the Buddha's life story, and here these canonical verses are still retained in the Mahavastu. We talked more about this last week in the class, but the Mahasanghika is one of the early schools of Buddhism. Yeah. Mahavastu means story. So Mahavastu literally just means the great story, and this is one of the versions of the Buddha's biography, and it's that version which was preserved and handed down through the Mahasanghika school. Okay.
What language is this? This
would be translated originally from Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, and now the one we're reading from at the moment I think it's translated directly from the hybrid Sanskrit actually, but there will be different versions and translations of this as well. I can't remember the Mahavastu exactly whether it's in Chinese or Tibetan, but certainly it exists in a hybrid Sanskrit version. The Khandaka.
Mm-hmm.
The Khandaka is the second half of the Vinaya, yeah? And so the Khandaka is more or less common to all of the schools of Buddhism, and in all the versions, or more or less all the versions that we have available to us, the Khandaka starts out with the enlightenment, and then tells the story of the Buddha's giving the first sermon, converting his first disciples, the ordaining of Sariputra Moggallana, and so on. And then it sort of breaks off and talks about Vinaya matters, and it picks up again with the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and the First and Second Councils. So the Khandikas actually has a large amount of the Buddha's biography already constructed as one literary text. Okay, so that's the first place where you find an actual large-scale text with a narrative of large portions of the Buddha's life, as opposed to sort of isolated episodes and incidents in the Buddha's life. Okay, so this Mahavastu calls itself a Vinaya text. And in some ways, it keeps the memory of that Vinaya passage, which, you know, you see here. This is more or less, these verses and some of these bits are actually taken from the Khandikas. All right. So you can see that basically you have a very similar depiction, but of course the details differ very greatly. And so let's have a look at another one. The Abhinishkramana Sutra, and this one translated into Chinese by Jnanagupta, a Buddhist priest from North India who resided in China during the Sui Dynasty, around the end of the 6th, is that right? Sui Dynasty? Around the end of the 6th century AD. Okay, so this is the note here by the translator. This was translated by Samuel Beale, who was a remarkable, English scholar who I think lived in, but certainly translated a lot of materials from Chinese in the 19th century. So he called it the romantic legend of Shakya Buddha, and the Chinese is the Abhinishkramana Sutra. Well, the Sanskrit original is Abhinishkramana Sutra, meaning the Abhinishkramana is the going forth. Now, very interesting thing here is that this little detail in the colophon, the little remarks made by the editor at the end of the last chapter of the book. Okay, and it's very stated there that this Abhinishkramana Sutra is called by the Dharmaguptakas the Phopen Hing Jing, which would be what? Basically the life of the Buddha, yeah? Buddha Charita, probably. And Buddha Charita, we just read from Ashvagosa, that means the life of the Buddha, literally. Yeah. By the Sarvastivadins, it is called Da Chuang Yen. Yeah, which is the Lalita Vistara. Would that be right? Yen meaning play or something like that? No? Which? No. No, no, yen wouldn't be play. The da is big. What would be the chuang di? Chuang. Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. And by the Mahasanghikas, it is called Dasu, i.e. Mahavastu. So what this little note is saying, this is by the Chinese, presumably by the Chinese translator, okay? And he's met in 600 CE. He said, this Abhinishkramana Sutra, the Dharmaguptakas call it the life of the Buddha, the Sarvastivadins call it the Lalita Vistara, and the Mahasanghikas call it the Mahavastu. So he's saying that, well, basically all of these schools have pretty much the same story, yeah, and they call their book by these different names. And so this is what when we're able to actually have a look at these in the different versions and see these different perspectives on the life of the Buddha. So this one was translated into Chinese from Sanskrit by a priest called Zhu Fan Lun as early as 69 or 70 AD. No, hang on. Didn't he say before 600?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, but there's several. Okay, it's getting a bit confusing now. But there are several translations of the Legend of Buddha translated under the same name. The first, which we alluded to, the original was lost as early as the beginning of the Tang Dynasty. Okay, so that first one translated about 70 AD was lost already by the beginning of the Tang Dynasty, and so on. So it goes into more discussion of that.
So this one is a
No, I don't think we know.
We don't.
Actually, what school this is. Beale might have some remarks here.
Well, which school hasn't got them?
Depends how you want to count schools, yeah. I'm not 100% sure whether the school of this text has been settled or not. Yeah. So, okay, here we go. The attack of Mara. Then, so this is the Buddha. We've already had Mara appeared a bit earlier. And the Bodhisattva going and sitting under the tree. And Mara and his hordes having a bit of a sort of assembling and so on already, and they've already got the descriptions of Mara's army and so on. But I'll just start with here, the attack of Mara. Then Mara Raja addressed the Yaksha Red Eye Lohidakshi. So this actually is a standard trope of Indian literature, that the Yakshas have got red eyes. And this is found in the very first of the Jataka stories in the Pali collection. And so it's kind of interesting kind of set of connotations that it may have here, but I don't want to kind of speculate about it too much, but it's fairly well known that imbibing certain chemical substances makes your eyes go red. And one wonders whether the memories or the idea of a yaksha is perhaps the idea of people who may be shamans or people who sort of went mad under the influence of certain substances. I don't know. Anyway, moving right along. In these words, Mara addressing his yaksha, Red Eye, you see before you this army of mine. Who is he that would wish to or dare to usurp the authority I possess over this world? Then the yaksha Red Eye answered Mara Raja and said, he is one named Siddhartha, son of Suddhodana, who from the time that he received the food of Sujata, the village maiden, has not ceased to advance onwards in the presence of many omens towards the tree of knowledge. Then Mara entertained the thought that he would tempt Bodhisattva to rest and spread his grass mat beneath some other tree and not proceed onwards to the Bodhi tree. Having thought of this, he called all the host of the Yakshas and said, go, all ye Yakshas, assemble at once beneath the Bodhi tree, nor suffer this child of the Sakyas to approach near it. They replied, we go to execute your commands. And so they proceeded to take their stand around the Bodhi tree. Then it was these Yakshas beheld the Bodhisattva coming, approaching the sacred precinct, his body shining like a mountain of pure gold, incomparable for beauty. Then the Yakshas, seeing him thus advancing, uttered the following verses. Surely this is the glory of the newly risen sun, shining as a golden mountain shines. In deep commiseration both for devas and for men, see like a lion how he slowly nears the tree. And the Bodhisattva approached the sacred spot, holding the grass in his left hand. He arranged it with his right hand on the eastern side of the tree and so sat down. And as he took his seat, he vowed that he would never rise again until he had attained enlightenment. So this is the motif of placing the grass under the Bodhi tree. Then the earth quaked 6 times. Upon this, Mara Pisuna, the lord of the Kama Lokas, the sense spheres, repaired to the place where the Bodhisattva was seated and said, thou son of a Kshatriya, it is not agreeable to me that you should make your seat here under this tree, nor is it safe for you, for in the middle of the night there are countless demons and ogres who come here to devour the flesh of men and quaff their blood. But to the north of the tree there is a grove where all the great rishis dwell. It is close to the village of Uruvilva. Uruvilva, a very delightful spot indeed. Go therefore, thou son of the Sakya race, and take up your abode there. So this is a new kind of temptation which we haven't found in the other versions. To which the Bodhisattva replied, and do you not know, Mara Pisuna, that I have for years dwelt as a hermit in the midst of the solitary mountains and woods, and in the hollows and dells of the lonely wastes, and yet have never feared such midnight visitors? And now I have come here, not without purpose and design, for I know full well that beneath this tree all the Buddhas have attained to the condition of supreme wisdom, and for this reason and with this end in view, I have come here and taken up my abode. Then a certain yaksha who stood on Mara's right hand said, "And why, O child of the Sakyas, should you select this tree for your further sufferings? There are others on every side better than this one. Get thee hence to some other place." So they're making a big deal about the tree. It's got to be this particular Bodhi tree, otherwise it's just not going to work. To whom the Bodhisattva replied, "I am persuaded that beneath no other tree but this can I fulfill my vow, but only beneath this one. I am resolved, therefore, to remain here." And then there's the verse, "Bodhisattva seated with his legs crossed beneath the tree, even as the mighty snake coils himself up and rests, resolved in his, and strong in his resolve, made this vow, until my aim be accomplished, I will rise no more." Okay. So then Maharaja, having disappeared for a moment, transformed himself into the figure of a messenger with disordered garments and disheveled hair, panting as if with haste and anxiety, and holding in his hands a bundle of official notices as if from all the Sakyan princes. Okay, so he's like the council representative who's coming to evict him from the trees. This is, the army's not going to work, maybe the bureaucrats will. With these he approached to where the Bodhisattva was, and opening his mouth he said, "These notices, O Manava," this is a term of address, "are from the Sakyan princes to you. This is from Nandika, from Anuruddha, Devaka, from Nandi, from Ananda. Now in all these letters was written the false report that Devadatta had usurped the government of Kapilavastu and entered the palace of Bodhisattva, taken his goods, ravished his wives, and placed Suddhodana fast bound in prison. They ordered the Bodhisattva, therefore, to return to restore peace and order to the government." The Bodhisattva reflected that lust had caused the Devadatta to act thus to the women, and natural malice had made him imprison Suddhodana, while the Sakyas, in not defending their king, had shown a cowardly and hateful disposition. Thinking thus on the follies and weaknesses of the natural heart, his own resolution to obtain something higher and better was confirmed and strengthened within him. Very interesting, isn't it? He seems to have believed Mara straight away. Yeah? Didn't act according to him, but he still believed him. Then, as Bodhisattva sat thus beneath the tree, the Deva who resided there to protect the precinct, filled with unutterable joy, cast all her ornaments before the Bodhisattva and with encouraging voice entreated him to persevere in his purpose. So here we have the goddess supporting the Buddha in his practice. We haven't yet found the earth goddess who was called to witness, but here is the tree deva. Then all of the devas of the surrounding trees coming to that tree deva inquired who the glorious being was, and hearing the circumstances they scattered flowers and perfumes and so on and so forth. And Mara was filled with rage. He said, "He wants to trample me underfoot. If he prevails, he will teach all men the way to nirvana. He will show them how to accomplish it. My kingdom will be at an end. I will drive him away by any possible expedient." He gathered his 1,000 sons, and Mara addressed them all with these words, and will ask their opinion, what's the best way to overthrow the Bodhisattva. And one of his sons said, "Would thou dare touch the great dozing snake? Would your strength be enough to meet the mad elephant? Would you fight with the king of beasts? Then you may also destroy this shamana." To whom Wicked Mouth, the other son of Mara, replied, "If a man but see me, his heart sinks within him. All the trees at my touch fall to the earth. How much more than this shamana, seeing me flee away at the sight and hide himself?" And so the two sons arguing with each other about whether to attack the Buddha or not. Bhadrapati, the minister, also tried to dissuade him. And then eventually he told them to get lost. He said he was going to attack them anyway. Then turning to his female attendants, he bade them use all their wiles to induce Bodhisattva to relent and give way to his passions. On this, in obedience to their lord's command, they went with a mincing gait, we have the mincing again, towards the spot where the Bodhisattva sat beneath the tree, and standing at a short distance from him, they proceeded to put into practice every ogling way and lascivious art they could. Some of them with their heads covered, others with their heads bare, some showing half their faces, others their entire face, some with dainty smiles to display their white teeth, some with eyes askance, looking at the Bodhisattva, others kneeling down before him and looking upwards into his face, others drooping their heads so as to conceal their faces and looking at one another, some raising their eyebrows, others opening and shutting their eyes, others combing out their disheveled hair, spreading out their arms, others raising their arms so as to show their bodies, others with their hands toying with their breasts, others half uncovered with their breasts and hips bare, and so on and so on and so forth, and going on at some length. And so this is how long it is, but this is of course abbreviated. And of course the Bodhisattva remained unchanged in face and appearance, tranquil and at perfect rest he sat, even as the full moon when it emerges from the hands of Rahu the Asura, or when the sun first scatters his dazzling rays to the morning, or as the lily that reposes on the placid waters, or as the brightness of the flame firm as Mount Sinero, as the Bodhisattva was unmoved, even as the iron walls that surround the universe. It's an interesting bit of cosmology there, the iron walls that surround the universe. And without the least agitation, his heart and his mind at perfect rest, without fear or anxiety, and entirely self-possessed. So then the daughters of Mara then address the Buddha in the following verses. This early springtime, how fair the season, all the trees beginning to bud and flowers to bloom. Surely this is the time for pleasure and love. While you are in the prime of your beauty and youth, your appearance so graceful, your years so few, this is the time for you to indulge your desires. Your present search after supreme wisdom is hard to accomplish. Turn then and your thoughts from it and take your pleasure. Look at us and so behold our beauties and charms. And so on and so forth. And then they go on again some length. And then the Bodhisattva, unmoved by that. All those pleasures in which the world indulges are sources of sorrow, sin and distress. By reason of this, the worldling loses all spiritual discernment. Clouded with ignorance, he lives in darkness and gloom. Men are never satisfied with the enjoyment of these things, but I long ago have utterly discarded them and have escaped from their slavery as a man flees from a burning furnace or a poisonous drug, and so on and so forth. And the sense desires are like the bubble that arises on the water, light as a dream, unreal as a phantom, hollow and false, and so on and so forth. Goes on. And then the Mara's daughters back again arguing with him, and back again. So again, you can see how these different episodes, you know, Ashvaghosha passed over this in just a few lines, and as did the others, and now this has been so emphasized in this particular version. So the women finally left him. And wished him success in these words, that which your heart desires may you attain, and finding for yourself deliverance, deliver all. Interesting. So finally he managed to convert them. So Mara goes back and tries to frighten him once more. And this being an example of the structure of the Mahavastu, the Mara's already been there and tried to frighten him, but that didn't work, and now he's trying again. So this is probably just the result of placing together different textual sources without much thought for the actual flow of the narrative. And another exchange between the Buddha and Mara. And then Mara addressed the Bodhisattva, "The son of Sakyans, rise up and be gone from this place. Very truly you shall become a supreme Chakravarti monarch, governing the four quarters of the world, lord over the great earth, possessed of the seven imperial insignia, ruling over all hills and vales." Okay, so here Mara is again tempting the Buddha with kingship, and expressing how much he fears for the Bodhisattva's safety. Indulge in the pleasures of life and forget thy present quest. So again, Mara posing as the compassionate one. Mara stood silently before the Bodhisattva, and the Bodhisattva replied, "Don't waste your words, Mara, for well do I know the miseries attending the indulgences of pleasure and the gratifications of sense. These inconstant and perishable, empty and unreal, like the dew on the leaf, to be avoided as the touch of an angry snake," and so on and so forth. So, so then he goes on trying to persuade him with gentle words. When that doesn't work, Mara becomes enraged, and then threaten him. "Do you see my big army there, the Yakas and the Nagas, riding on a pitch-black cloud and launching forth their fiery lightnings? I shall smite thee in twain with my sword as the warrior youth divides the plantain tree at a stroke." And He said again, even if this whole world were filled with devils, each grasping his sword, heavy and large as Mount Sumeru, not one hair of my head should they injure. And going on, again, the description of the army and so on. And again, the monstrous army with all the different kinds of shapes and so on. They came in from the four quarters like the four great seas, swelling their waves, and the earth shook, and so on. And Mara keeps on threatening him, and they attack him. And then it has the detail that the weapons stuck to their hands. Other weapons broke into fragments and dispersed themselves through space. Meanwhile, the ones which they hurled, thick as the rays of the sun when it shines forth from a dark cloud, these changed themselves to flowers and fell at the feet of the Bodhisattva. Some of the horde were rendered blind so they couldn't see, others were unable to move. And so on. An angel from the pure abodes come and tells Mara not to continue. And so it keeps on going with the encouragement of the devas and the attacks of Mara. And the translation has abbreviated it. So leading up to the enlightenment. So this is the romantic legend of Buddha, the Maha Abhinishkramana Sutra. In the going form. So, one interesting detail, we haven't had the motif of the calling forth the earth goddess to witness, which is a very common feature in the iconography. And I believe... Well, that was close to the same thing, because he's pounding on the earth, but there's an actual text where he actually calls the earth goddess comes to him, and they have there's a dialogue and discussion. Now I think that may be in the Lalita Vistara, but it's not in this version here, which is not a complete translation. I'll see if I can find a more complete translation. Mm-hmm. Buddha's Enlightenment. Oh, this is from the this is not really the Lalita Vistara, this is from the That's what we had in the. This is as told in Borobudur. No, it doesn't give the details. So this is the Pali version. So this is the Jataka Nidana, and is the. Given as the introduction to the Jataka books, so that's what the Jataka word Jataka Nidana means. So it gives the story of the offering of the milk rice by Sujata, and then he ate that. And then made a determination with the golden vessel. If he's going to become Buddha, let the bowl go upstream. If not, let it go downstream. And he threw it into water and it went upstream. And then he went to the place of enlightenment. They came from the opposite direction, a grass cutter called Sotia, who recognized the great ban and gave him 8 bundles of grass. And he took the grass and made the seat. And then comes to the army of Mara episode. That time the Deva Mara, thinking, Prince Siddhartha wants to free himself from my dominion, I will not let him get free yet. He went to the hosts of his Maras and he told the news, and sounding the drum called Mara Cry, he led forth the hosts of Mara. That army of Mara stretches 12 leagues before him, 12 leagues to the left and right. Behind him it stretches, that's about 100 miles on either side. Before him stretches to the rocky limits of the world, above him it's 9 leagues in height. When the sound of its war cry is hurled 12 leagues away, even as the sound of an earthquake. Mara Deva mounted his elephant 250 leagues high. Okay, so that's an elephant that's 2,500 miles high. It's an elephant as big as Australia, alright? It's a big elephant. created himself a thousand arms and seized all kinds of weapons, and the remainder two of the company of Mara no Two took the same weapon, but assuming various colours and various forms, they went on to overwhelm the great being. But the devas of the 10,000 world systems continued speaking the praises of the great being. Saka, the deva king, stood there blowing his trumpet. Vijayutara, now that trumpet is 120 cubits long and can itself cause the wind to enter and thus itself give forth a sound which will resound for 4 months when it becomes still. And so on, there's different, the devas uttering there. So we still have many of them. We have this motif of the devas uttering the praise of the Buddha, while Mara and so on, are trying to oppose him. Now, as the army approached and surrounded the seat under the Bodhi tree, not one of the hosts of Mara was able to stay, and they fled, each one from the spot where the army met them. The black one, king of the Nagas, dived to earth and went to Manjarika, the palace of the Nagas, 500 leagues in length, and lay down, covering his face with his face with his hands. This black one, who's this? I'm trying to think who that is in Pali. But it's not Mara. Saka, taking the Vijayutra trumpet on his back, stopped at the rocky verge of the world, Mahabrahma, putting the white canopy of state onto the summit of the rocks at the end of the earth, went to the world of Brahma. Not a single deity was able to keep his place. The great man sat there alone. But Mara said to his company, "Sirs, there is no other man like Siddhartha, the son of Suddhodana. We cannot give him battle face to face. Let us attack him from behind." The great man looked around on three sides and saw that all the devas had fled and their place was empty. Then beholding the host of Mara coming thick upon him from the north, he thought, "Against me alone this mighty host is putting forth all its energy and strength. No father is here, nor mother, nor brother, nor any other relative to help me. But those 10 perfections have long been to me as retainers fed from my store. So, making the perfections like a shield, I must strike this host with the sword of perfection and thus overwhelm it." And so he sat meditating on the 10 perfections, the 10 paramis. Then Maradeva, saying, "Thus I will drive away Siddhartha," caused a whirlwind to blow. And immediately such winds rushed together from the four corners of the earth as could have torn down the peaks of mountains half a league, 2 leagues, 3 leagues high, could have rooted up the shrubs and trees of the forest and could have made of the towns and villages around one heap of ruins. But through the glow of the merit of the great man, they reached him with all their power gone, and even the hem of his robe they could not shake. Then they thought, "We'll overwhelm him with water and so slay him." And so a great torrent and hundreds of thousands and great flood over the trees and so on. But they couldn't even wet him with one dewdrop. And then a storm of rocks fell, but they, as they fell, spitting fire and smoke with great mountain peaks falling on him, they reached the Bodhisattva and changed to divine garlands. Again, this motif of the changing into flowers. Again, with the deadly weapons that came, and they also changed to flowers. The storm of charcoal, embers, sand, a storm of mud, and so on, a thick darkness, which did, and they all of them disappeared before the Bodhisattva. So then he said, "I failed with all of these things," so he called on his host and said, "Seize or slay or drive away this prince." And he said to the Buddha, "Get up, Siddhartha, from that seat. It does not belong to thee, it belongs to me." The great being listened to his words and said, "Mara, it is not by you that the 10 perfections have been perfected, neither the lesser perfections nor the higher perfections." So in these details, of course, this being the notion of the 10 perfections, the 10 paramis being specific to the Theravadan school, usually being 6 paramis in the earlier versions, but notice that the paramis haven't been really mentioned in the other accounts. "It's not you who have sacrificed yourself in the 5 great acts of renunciation, nor have you perfected the way of good in knowledge, nor the way of good for the world, nor the way of understanding. This seat does not belong to thee, it is to me that it belongs." Then the enraged Mara, unable to endure the vehemence of his anger, cast at the great man the scepter javelin of his, the barb of which was in shape as a wheel. But it became a wreath of flowers and remained over him as a canopy, whose mind was bent upon the 10 perfections. And so when they saw this, the company of Mara shouted, and they hurled at him masses of rock, but these two fell to his ground like flowers. And so then they had this motif of the witnessing. The great man said, "To me belongs the seat on which sit the Buddhas to be when they have fulfilled perfection on the day of their enlightenment. And he said to Mara, standing there before him, Mara, who is witness that thou hast given alms? And Mara, okay, so he's asking, so this is the first barometer, okay, so he's asking who has witnessed these barometers that he's developed, okay, so the first one is a barometer of dana. And so he's asking Mara, if you think you belong to this seat, who is there to claim that you have been a generous person? And Mara stretched forth his hand to the host of his followers and said, so many are my witnesses. At that moment there rose a shout as the sound of an earthquake from the company of Mara saying, I am his witness, I am his witness. And then the tempter addressed the great man and said, Siddhartha, who is witness that thou hast given alms? And the great man answered, you have living witnesses that thou hast given alms, but I have in this place no living witnesses at all, but not counting the alms that I've given in other births, lest let this great and solid earth, unconscious though it be witness of the 700-fold great alms I gave when I was born as Vaisantara. And so, of course, being the last of the Jataka stories and the culmination of the development of the Dana Paramita according to the Pali tradition, Vaisantara not having the same significance in the northern traditions. So this is a sort of sectarian influence here. Withdrawing his right hand from beneath his robe, he stretched it down towards the earth and said, art thou or art thou not witness of the 700-fold great gift I gave in my birth as Vaisantara? And then the next two pages are not shown in this preview. So we don't get that little bit yet there. As I said, I'm sure we've got this book around here somewhere, but I just can't find it. So we're reliant on Google Books, which has let us down right at the crucial point then. Anyway, so this is where the Earth Goddess comes to her witness.
So when he witnesses the Earth, he's still the Bodhisattva. It's not the Buddha.
That's right. He's still the Bodhisattva. Yeah.
But in there's a lot of Tibetan Buddha images that
happen touching
the Earth.
That's right. Yeah. And that is called the Bhumisparsha Mudra, and it's very common. I mean, it's probably the most common in iconography. I'm just trying to see if there's a version. As I said, I think some of the northern versions definitely have that motif, and I think it's a Lalita Visara, which unfortunately I can't find that particular. I can't find that particular section of it. This is an image of the photo. That's an image there. But it's depicted very commonly in the iconography. These are sort of modern paintings. What have we got here? This is more like Mara and the it's calling the Earth to witness, but they look more like Mara's daughters rather than the Earth Goddess. Wandering stray cat. Yeah, this is a Thai image of what they call Pramaya Torani, is the Earth Goddess. So this being a this is the water. See, she's identified with the Ganges. It's this, she's part of or part of the mythic cycle of the Ganges River. Images. What else we got? Oh, here we have one. It's a bit smaller. Oh, that's good. So this one here. Okay, so this is again is a Thai one, and there's the Buddha. There's the Mara's armies being discomforted around him, and here's the Earth Goddess with her hair. So she's said to drown the army of Mara with the water that comes from her hair. And this is another version of the same scene. Mara's great elephant and all of the monsters and so on. They're not that monstrous, are they? This one. But as you can see, very popular in Thai Buddhism. I'm not sure about other places, whether Sri Lanka. Do you see that one in Sri Lanka, Chandra? That picture with the calling the earth goddess to witness and the hair and so on. You can't remember that in Sri Lanka? The picture seems to be all from Thailand. Anyway. Okay. Alright, so I come back to the text that we were just at, and we'll just finish this off where we were. And so this is now just skipped over a couple of pages, so then it just describes the beauty of the world once the Buddha attains enlightenment. The trees, even the creepers, were covered with blossom, the lotus wreaths hung from the sky, and lilies by seven sprang one above another, each from the very rocks. The 10,000 world systems as they revolved seemed like a mass of loosened wreaths, or like a nosegay tastefully arranged. Would somebody like to illuminate us? What's a nosegay?
Like a
wreath or... Yeah, all right. And the world voids between them, the hells whose darkness the rays of the seven suns had never been able to disperse, became filled with light. The sea became sweet water down to its profoundest depths, and the rivers were stayed in their courses. The blind from birth received their sight, the deaf from birth heard sound, the lame from birth could use their feet, and chains and bonds were loosed and fell away. So on. And then it has the verses... Anekajati Sansarang Sandhavisang Anibisang, which is the very famous verse about the wandering through samsara and destroying the house builder. I should tell that one to Patrick, he'd like that. And so it's just there's one reason to notice this is because it was mentioned last week, and it's often said that the Theravada tradition is kind of more restrained and so on than the other traditions. And I think it's a bit of a misnomer. I think sometimes it is, but very often the Theravadan texts are just as extravagant as what we find in other traditions.
Which version is in the Alicana?
None of them.
So this story is is this story?
That was last week. The Pali Canon essentially has episodes and bits and pieces which are remembered from the life of the Buddha, which are found both in the Pali Canon and also in the Chinese Agamas, which were from a similar time. So, I mean, in a sense that represents something, I mean, that's quite realistic in terms of our memory and knowledge of people's lives, that actually you don't know someone's life from a narrative story that someone tells you from the beginning to the end, but you learn bits and pieces of, you know, this happened on that day, or this episode, or this memory, or something. And so then that gradually came to be compiled into a life story of the Buddha. So the first large-scale attempt at that was the work I referred to before as the Khandikas in the Vinaya, which has a large proportion of the Buddha's life story, but still not a complete life story. And so that narrative was then filled out later. And so these texts that we're looking at now, I would place it between maybe 300-400 years after the Buddha, up until, you know, over a period of several hundred years after that. And that's what I would refer to as the classical form of the Buddhist mythology. He's only really referred to as the Bodhisattva he's not referred to as the Bodhisattva in past lives. And he's only really referred to as Bodhisattva when discussing after he's gone forth. So there's one or two exceptions to that, but as a general rule, the word Bodhisattva in the earliest part of the Pali Canon seems to mean the one who's actually left forth and is striving for enlightenment. Yeah. So he will talk about his past lives and so on, but he doesn't call himself a Bodhisattva in those.
So is this kind of absolute
As I mentioned at the beginning, it's found in Suttanipata, the earliest version of it. So it has a much attenuated version, but it basically has a short exchange with Mara. It also has the episode with Mara's daughters in there. in the Mahavagga of the Suttanipata. And it mentions the 10 armies of Mara, but the 10 armies of Mara are just 10 kinds of defilements. There's no mention of the actual armies that we have here. Okay, so that's probably enough for one day.